Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello and welcome back to the Undercut Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Billington, and I'm joined, as always, by the shiny little bald, my roulette wheel, Timo Alvis Daly, and the valve cover to my floor pan, Ellie Mae Taylor. How are you both?
I already feel violated when I'm even 10 seconds in.
All I said was you're a shiny little ball. What's wrong with that?
It was more the pairing with whatever monstrosity you called Ellie Mae just there. It didn't sound right.
Valve cover to my floor pan. Did you not see FP1?
Well, no, actually, I didn't see it live because who the hell would? Not even the fans got the opportunity for us to do it anyway. But yeah, no, I'm good anyway. I'm just going to draw a line swiftly under that. And anyway, how are you? Please talk.
I'm good, thank you.
No qualms about being called a valve cover?
No, I sort of got stuck on the bit where Timo's a little ball.
Shiny little ball, like the little one you put into the roulette wheel and you spin it around and put it all on red bull, more like. Anyway, yes, as you might have guessed, we're back to review all the action from this weekend's Las Vegas Grand Prix, and we'll be taking a look back at, well, we haven't actually got any of the real news from this weekend. There's quite a lot to actually pick apart from Las Vegas, and I think a lot of bits we want to discuss. So we'll launch straight into the weekend with the opening gambit, which was Jacques Villeneuve getting married in the paddock. We had mentioned beforehand that there was a tiny chapel of love that had been set up in, like, actually in the paddock itself, and Jacques tied the knot with his partner Julia in the chapel of love, and the couple were treated to an intro of the F1 theme. So as they walked in, they obviously had the F1 theme march them in, followed by the traditional Wagner's bridal chorus, with proceedings being overseen by an Elvis impersonator. So very much the stereotypical Las Vegas wedding with a slight Formula One twist.
If anyone was going
to, he got paid to get married in the paddock, no? Because that, I mean, again, I know what you're saying there, Emil, about to say that, like, if anyone was going to do it, it does make sense that, of course, it's Villeneuve, but really, yeah, that loaf of cash that you're going to get married in, like, if he's done that for free, I feel like that's a missed opportunity on his part, but really, that's where you're going to get married? Really?
Why not? I mean, who else has got married in an F1 circuit as F1 is going on?
No one, because no one's ever thought that's a good idea.
I think it's a good idea.
I sort of side with Timo, I sort of side with Ellie Mae. If you're the 1997 F1 world champion, obviously
you've got to stay relevant somehow, because no one cares what you think right now anyway these days, because it just comes up with crazy and crazier things. But at the same time, man, just...
It's not my style.
Calm it down a notch.
It's not my style of wedding. I wouldn't opt to have that. If it's what he wanted, I can see that he potentially enjoyed that, even if all of his wedding guests were simply the assembled press. Like, just sort of, you come out and there's Luke Smith and Chris Medland there going, well done, I guess. We did, this was a surprise.
They're thinking, I am so fatigued right now from this weekend. Is this happening or am I hallucinating? No, somehow I've woken up the next day and that did actually happen.
They wouldn't have been
actual fudge.
Too fatigued at that point, because this was like Thursday night or Friday night. So it was... Yeah, this was...
I'm just going to assume they got there on like Tuesday or Wednesday and the time difference is still messing with them.
Oh, yeah, I saw a brilliant tweet from Zhou Guanyu talking about the time zooms that he's had to skip through to get to Abu Dhabi. He sort of misspelled his tweet, and which really pointed out the fact that they've covered like 12 time zones to literally get to Abu Dhabi for the back-to-back from Vegas to deal with it all. And I think people are going to be arriving in Abu Dhabi absolutely knackered, because equally, teams will have been working till sort of 3-4 o'clock in the morning, stripping down their paddocks and pens after the Grand Prix. Like on Friday Friday night, Saturday morning. I think that's the right way around the days go. Like teams would have been still ploughing on till nearly 5, 6 a.m. doing like debriefs and post FP2 stuff. Like the times were a bit manic. And I don't think anyone thought that far ahead. With Singapore, because it's a night race, plans are in place for hotels to have 24-hour food and 24-hour service so that the teams can operate on essentially a conventional time zone, which just means they happen to sort of be nocturnal at that point. They sort of adapt to a night shift before they even get there. Whereas with Vegas, none of that preparation or planning seemed to have been put into place, which was an interesting outcome.
You'd also think being in the Northern Hemisphere, it'd get dark fairly quickly, would it not?
Yeah, relatively quickly. Like, I just think the sun sets there about sort of 6, 6.30-ish.
So we could have had a race in the dark.
Dusk, and you'd have got much the same effect.
Yeah, but it's not as exciting as saying we had it at 10 or at midnight. It's 6 o'clock.
But then who sleeps in Las Vegas?
But apparently the locals do, but...
Well, you don't get the chance, because even if you did, the fireworks will blow bloody woken you up at the end of it.
Yeah, and FP2 went on till like 3.30 in the morning or something ridiculous. But we'll get back to all the timing things, because there's a few more points to add into that one. But after Jacques Villeneuve got married, obviously we mentioned the Chapel of Love was set up in the pits and paddock. The F1, this was an interesting side of things. F1 actually bought the land that turns 1-2 and everything was situated on, and the pit building and the paddock area itself. And they spent $500 million on that pit building, and they forgot to put a media office in it. Every square inch of that GP has been monetized to within an inch of its life, seemingly at the expense of actually being practical to many people. I don't know what life was like for the teams actually on the ground, how much space they had to operate within, where they had to park lorries, where they had to actually store stuff. But when it came to sort of production and media, like there was a commentary off booth, and that was it. Like there was no standard office. Like any man,
who needs a media office anyway?
Sport that relies on a huge amount of people writing and producing stories across the weekend.
The whole city is the media office. It's just a Vegas thing. You clearly didn't get that press memo, so you just got to work with it in Vegas. That's just part of the charm of the place. They did that on purpose. You're beginning to talk like you expect that Las Vegas Grand Prix was not well organized, and I don't know where you're getting these kind of crazy ideas from.
It's fine. I'm going to do the Max Verstappen. I'm going to start off really negative at the top of the podcast, and by the end of this, I'm going to be singing Elvis, singing along to Elvis Presley in the car, wearing an Elvis Presley inspired race suit, and I'm going to be really optimistic for it and want to go to the club. Over the course of this,
as long as you don't have to listen to that, then that's fine.
I was going to say the opposite. I was going to say, can you sing Viva Las Vegas?
Yeah,
and you're clearly very ill.
Well, we already knew that.
Yeah, that's just a long-running thing. But anyway, with obviously expensive pit building aside, there's a few other issues with sort of infrastructure around Vegas, shall we say. And one of the footbridges across the circuit failed. This failed quite early on in the weekend. And when I say it failed, it suffered a structural failure and had to be shut to all foot traffic. And this is one of the reasons why they were blocking views on the bridges to avoid overloading. But even with just the increased foot traffic, it seems that some of the bridges clearly weren't rated for that, or just hadn't been maintained properly enough to sustain that. So it's a little bit concerning there, and I think that hopefully the organisers and the civil engineers that put it all together will have learned a lot when it comes to managing that amount of people kicking around.
Was it a footbridge that was already there in Vegas, or was it a...
I believe it was a footbridge that was already in Vegas. The details were kind of hazy. I got it as sort of like one of those stories that worms its way out of the paddock from sort of quiet team members that don't want to be sort of seen to ruffle feathers, but the story gets out. And essentially it was one that was open to the public. And just there was all massive people having to then sort of go to other bridges, making the situation worse. And yeah, it was a bit of a nightmare. There wasn't designated walkways or like cut through channels for press, team members, for videographers, photographers, camera operators, because usually at circuits you've got sort of lots of cut throughs and underground sort of underpasses, so you can get to locations to shoot, report from, interview from, operate the TV cameras from. There wasn't actually much of that around Vegas. You just had to sort of use the public walkways and then cut in, which, again, not hugely practical when it comes to putting on a race and getting it filmed for TV, I don't know, or sort of broadcast from. You sort of forgot that you might actually have to show someone the Grand Prix at some point.
Well, they did forget that partway through the kind of the coverage anyway, at times of some of the shots they were using. Here's a bit of track where something's going to happen, and then it doesn't. It's about 10 seconds of empty track, and then cut back to it later when, oh, now there's a car there, or here's a helicopter shot, but you genuinely can't see shit.
Yeah, you... when it comes to actually sort of showing you bits, this was something that I sort of cropped up for me across the weekend. From like the low down angles, from looking from trackside, look, you could have really been anywhere. Even from some of the car on boards, you could have been.
It did make me think they'd employed the Monaco TV people to come in and be like, "Do you want a second Grand Prix?"
Yeah, but you could have been any visually. You could have been anywhere. Like there was no significant clues until they cut to a helicopter shot that you're in Vegas. Like short of when they go past the sphere and everything is bathed in the blue, green, and red colours of the Chrome logo for a second.
Glad you brought up the sphere, by the way, because I just wanted to interject slightly, and I think they missed out on a really good opportunity with that, because of all of the things they kept projecting onto the sphere, I think during qualifying in particular, this would have been excellent. At the end of each qualifying session, you've got a giant sphere there, put the Death Star on it, and then you've got a picture of the driver, and then you just beam it to have the beam come out. That driver's been eliminated. Do that 5 times, next one over, have a fun Star Wars crossover, because everything else looks a bit odd on the sphere.
So on the cooldown lap,
perfect for it.
Yeah, on the cooldown lap after a Q1 and Q2, the drivers that have been eliminated as they're doing their cooldown lap back to the pits, the Death Star sort of pivots and sort of...
Yeah, just takes aim and just...
Again, I don't hate that as a concept.
We carry on with the Hunger Games theme sort of throughout the weekend, and we just have the little music go on, and then just that little like tribute to them on the sphere.
Yeah, that one. That would be. There were so many better ways they could have utilized quite a lot of Vegas-y stuff, and they sort of failed to, which feels like they sort of almost missed the point of hosting it in Vegas where they did. But
like not having an Elvis impersonate to do the
podium ceremonies,
national anthem. But I will say, I did feel like I was getting serenaded by Donny Osmond at 5:45 in the morning. So I wasn't. I didn't hate it. I thought he was actually quite good at it.
I didn't catch it, but apparently it was all right, better than Damian Lewis' British anthem.
What have you got against that man?
It was an awful rendition of the British National Anthem. I'm sorry, we've got a fairly decent National Anthem. It's a bit drudgy, but it's not bad. And he absolutely massacred it. I'm sorry, I haven't forgiven the man for that. Just a personal bugbear. But there were so many bits of, like, definitely like, oh, we're in Vegas across the weekend. There were so many bits where you just go, we could be anywhere. We might as well be in fucking Reno, Nevada. Like, it's just bright lights and glamour at that point. Like, there's nothing Vegas-y about it. Like, yeah, there was the Blue Man Group and Elvis impersonators pottering around the paddock, but where was the interesting people doing that for the podium celebrations? And yeah, I did like the boxing announcer doing like the roll call for people to come out and get into their parade cars, even if Checo Perez didn't seem to understand what was going on.
I think a lot of drivers got quite confused about what was going on.
Certainly Piastri and Norris, when they both ended up in the same car, mostly because I think Piastri's broke down on the starting grid, which, yeah, again, that was why there was huge amounts of concrete dust up and down the starting grid at the start of the race, was because some of the cars they had do the parade lap were leaking quite a bit of oil.
I think Perez and Hamilton had to end up sharing as well.
The two guys fighting for P2 in the championship. Buddy up, boys. Yeah, they weren't best happy about the fact that the cars have been leaking either, and then obviously left a greasy line and B, a load of dust to be kicked up as well. And I think that rather compounded when we actually came to the race start. But we'll get to that in a minute. We've still got the practice sessions where, surprisingly for once, the practice sessions actually had something worth watching for 9 minutes. FP1 was, of course, cancelled after 9 minutes when Carlos Sainz's car sucked a water valve cover out of the road, literally pulled the metal cover and some of the concrete holding it in out of the road. And obviously this flew up into the floor of his car, obliterated not only the floor, the survival cell, which is a very strong part of the car, the battery and various other low-hanging components from within the engine. So if we're talking, this gives you a great idea of understanding the energy that the cars create through the underfloor downforce, is the fact they can essentially project about 30 kilos of concrete and metal into the floor, enough to shatter it. That's impressive. Rumours, however, suggested that the track wasn't properly inspected prior to the weekend starting, and according to some sources, homologation reportedly wasn't signed off until just ahead of the weekend, like a few hours before FP1. The FIA hadn't gone round yet and gone, it's up to code, there you go, you can race on this now, which... Yeah, but it wasn't just Sainz's car that had damage caused by this. Ocon's car had possibly been the car that went over it first and did the initial sort of brush past. And his car also necessitated a chassis change, while Carlos took a new chassis, battery, engine and survival cell. The battery he used was beyond his pool of allocated parts as well. So as such, he was handed a 10-place grid penalty. Ferrari did put in to have that overturned, but reportedly one team rejected it. And I think everyone is wondering if that team was the one that was at the start of the race, certainly 20 points just had Ferrari 20 points behind them, and had obviously been suffering with Ferrari outscoring them in three of the last five races, excluding Vegas. I wrote this all while I was waiting for FP2. So yeah, it was Mercedes basically, people think, might have had Ferrari's template grid penalty enforced. Everyone else was going, it seems a bit unfair that the track obliterating your car means you get a template grid penalty.
I'm not sure how much sway the teams necessarily have on that sort of thing. Like, they could all have been voting unanimously, but then the stewards could have still gone, nah, rules are rules. Because they said to themselves, we don't want to have to do this, but we're going to do that because rules. And like, well, you're the guys who make the rules. You could just make the exception. You don't need the teams to be like, oh, we're all going to agree. And if they don't, then you can just use them as the scapegoats. It just seems a bit, if you're going to enforce it, but if you're not, you're literally the guys who get to decide if it's going to get enforced or not. Just don't be a dick. And especially after this stuff happens in Australia, Baku, Miami, you'd think as well that they'd check this sort of thing by now as well, especially a lot sooner in the weekend, like you say, not just a few hours before. And especially at a Grand Prix where you as F1 and Liberty want everything to go perfectly and you can't even get 10 minutes into the first session without cocking it up. It's just, you know, I mean, everyone's like, yeah, Mercedes this, Mercedes that, which maybe they did. We're not going to know that anytime soon, but it's just like, is that just the stewards going, yeah, their fault, nothing to do with us.
I mean, well, in terms of Carlos Sainz getting his penalty, I mean, I assume because they weren't going to let him off because it wasn't in the regulations to say sort of, they could do that. I assume that the regulations will now change to accommodate this in the future, but it seems pretty...
I'd like to see that in writing.
It seems so ridiculous. And I would have thought there would be someone in the FIA at the race or even at their headquarters that could give, I guess, such a permission. But I sort of wonder whether part of me wonders... whether this perhaps harks back to the days of Michael Massey and Abu Dhabi, and perhaps the power that a race director has or the FIA have has been somewhat reduced and the regulations now have to be followed a lot tighter because these are regulations. They're not law. I would have thought they would have been able to change it. I don't know.
No, I'm not saying that they necessarily could change it, but it's just kind of this thing of, just say you're enforcing it. Don't say, oh, we wish we didn't have to, because then people will then just question, well, why did you? Is there not room to maneuver? Just say, yeah, it's unfair, but rules are rules, and just keep it really neutral and don't say, oh, we do have sympathy, just play it straight down the middle and be, nah, rules are rules. Yeah, it's annoying, but that's what it is. We can maybe review that, like you say, to if there's an incident of that happening in the future, to accommodate that accordingly. If it's, because again, nowhere near Carlos Sainz or Ferrari's fault at all. That could have happened to anyone. And if we go down the route of believing that Mercedes were the ones to have some kind of influence on this, you best believe that if that had been Lewis or George's car, that wouldn't have been the case, and they'd have wanted to vote to change that all instead. So it just seems, I don't know, just be strict about it and just be not biased in any way, not necessarily, but just don't have any further comments. Like, yep, that's the rule. No comment out on anything else.
Well, it weighs into the fact that there was, between FP1 and FP2, they held like a sort of impromptu team principals press conference. And Fred Vasseur was visibly very annoyed about the whole situation. All the other team bosses seemed sort of pretty much on his side. They're like, yeah, that seems kind of unfair that you could be facing a grid penalty for something that wasn't your fault. Like, if Carlos had binned it into the wall and they had to replace all those bits, fair enough, on Ferrari's head, be it, was sort of very much their case. But they said this was beyond Ferrari's control. This was very much sort of force majeure. And the only person going against them was clearly Toto going, sort of very much anti the idea of Ferrari sort of getting any leeway in this. And it was an interesting one to watch and look at the dynamic between all the principals and see who was upset about what. And especially given the fact that despite being hit with that 10 place grid penalty, Sainz still outfinished both Mercedes, really shows sort of, not necessarily, I don't say the word threatened, but certainly shows that Toto is looking over his shoulder a certain extent at Ferrari and the performance they seem to be putting together in the latter half of this season to go, if the W15, whatever it is, doesn't come quite as good as we keep lauding it to be, we might have a struggle next year if Ferrari are able to keep going with this trajectory. So it's put the willies up Mercedes, I'd say.
Well, I think as well, it's that they're obviously going to lose millions if Ferrari now overtake Mercedes, and it doesn't quite seem... I mean, I think it's still impressive from how they started off from the start of the season. They sort of really early on said, OK, let's scrap this car. Let's just start making the one sort of for later in the season and next year. And it has... It's paid off for them. And I think if you said earlier on in the year you can get third, they probably wouldn't be so mad. But because now they've been in second for a fair while now, when sort of Aston Martin fell back, I guess it kind of hurts them that it's Abu Dhabi, that then that might potentially get it taken off of them. But I think what was really interesting as well in that press conference was when a journalist, when they opened it up to anyone asking questions, a journalist said something along the lines of, you know, do you think the issues with the water valve cover that led to the damage to the Ferrari and the cancellation of FP1 is a black eye for the sport? And Toto became extremely angered by this. And what was it? I've lost
one. He really didn't like that at all. He seemed very suspiciously pro-Vegas on that one. I will say that it was seemingly, but it was just kind of defending it way more than you'd expect him to.
There are a lot of moments where you get the impression that people had been told to speak very positively about Vegas, and you're sort of thinking...
Well, it's kind of thing, if you're working for F1 and that's how you get your paycheck, and you're not in a position where you can't... If you're not a Martin Brundle or Jenson Button, where you don't really need to be there, you can't really afford to say anything negative about the Grand Prix. You've got to have the party line.
But if you're employed by F1, it's different to if you're employed by Mercedes AMG Formula One team.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's curious. He's in that middle ground there of he doesn't need to say either, and he can say as much or as little as he wants, but then it gets curious whichever way you go if you lean into it quite hard.
As to which party line he's towing for whom and why.
I don't know. It kind of got me thinking, do we have a duty to like sort of narrate or anticipate events more positively, because a lot of people, for me anyway, came into Las Vegas almost wanting Las Vegas to fail. And there was very sort of little positivity on the event coming into it. And we had to remember sort of, and this was Toto's point, that there's a huge team behind this and they've worked hard to create an event. And in fact, I think aside from Hungary, where the promotion of the event is led by Arjen Frank Mühlenbelt, it's the only other Grand Prix to have planning and development led by females, yet very little news outlets actually covered this. And there was any positive press on it prior to Las Vegas actually happening. And I'm by no means saying we shouldn't cover aspects that aren't okay or perhaps been handled incorrectly, because we do have a duty to also provide that information. And I just think, should we be kind of having this narrative of almost coming into an event wanting it to fail?
I don't think going in and wanting it to fail is necessarily the mindset. I think when you have something new that's being presented as a very different concept to what's quite a sort of set in stone sport, you have a right to be sort of to question it and to be suspect as to how it's going to approach. Bear in mind the sort of, if you follow cricket any amount, you know how much sort of lack or sort of throwback there was against the 100 when that was launched, and that worked perfectly when it came in. People were like, oh no, this makes 100% sort of sense. You throw 100 balls, it's how much you can score off 100 overs, end. And it became a really fast-paced, interesting way of introducing a new audience to cricket. And Formula One is trying something similar in that regard of trying to introduce new things to get a new audience. And yes, that needs criticism, but at the same time, it does need praise. And I think, like you said, you can't go into it wanting it to fail. And I know a lot of people went into the 100 when it was introduced to cricket wanting it to fail, because they're like, no, we can't change it. We need to have sort of huge sort of 5-day long test matches that go on for hours and hours and hours. And there was this sort of very much sort of standoffish sense from cricket against sort of this new concept. And it didn't look good as an outsider. So I can't imagine that everyone hoping for the downfall of Vegas looked good from an outsider's perspective with regards to Formula One. I certainly, yeah, view it with suspicion, view it with a critical eye, view it with sort of a journalistic intent to sort of ask, why has this been done this way? What would you do better? More than simply go, well, this is a bit naff, isn't it? And Toto does.
So I wonder how much of it was down to the fact that saying you're dead against something before it's even happened just goes better on social media, because it's more in your face about, and everything is going to, yeah, clickbaity. It's just going to get the attention going. Whereas if you did what we essentially said in the preview, we're not really sure what to expect here. We're going to go in with an open mind, and it would be nice to be pleasantly surprised, and we can get to what we actually thought of it a bit later. But it kind of, we're not wanting it to fail. We're just confused about the methodology employed for doing this, because no one really asked for Vegas back. We were kind of not confused when they made it, but we were kind of all rolling our eyes when they did announce it. Like, oh, that's going to be, we had a preset notion of how it was going to be in a lot of ways with the pre and post race entertainment, quote unquote. There was a lot of that, of what we expected it to be sort of thing. And it's not necessarily being against it, but it's just knowing what is going to be there. It might not be our cup of tea, but that's not necessarily saying that we're wanting the entire thing to fail so badly that it's going to never happen again. It's just, you can find that middle ground. You want it to do well, because at the end of the day, we all love F1 and you want it to be good. So it's annoying when you see a method that you're not convinced is going to work in attracting and keeping new fans and old ones at the same time, if that makes sense. You've got to balance that line. And I think it's very easy to just say, oh, I want this to fail because it's not exactly as I wanted it to be. But then you've got 10 different people saying that, and what they all want individually is very different from each other.
Mm. There's definitely different ways of approaching it and asking the questions of it, but certainly going into it with at least an open mind is arguably the best MO. But there were still more problems to come, because of course we had to wait for the track to be repaired. There were still holes out the front of the commentary box that were being filled in prior 15 minutes prior to the start of the late FP2.
Ventilation.
But obviously, once FP2 got underway, it was actually run behind closed doors, because marshals and stewards on the fan side of things had clocked off for the night. There were bus drivers, there were sort of coordination personnel that were only sort of signed on to work until a certain time. And there was no means for them to work an extra period of time, because working that late in the day, working that length of a shift is sort of barred by American employment law. So obviously, F1 had to follow that. And it meant that basically fans were ushered out. Despite the fact they'd waited around to watch the free practice session, and they were sort of led from their seats, and that was the end of that. And it very much suggests that the race organisers hadn't foreseen there possibly being a delay between practice sessions or anything in that regard. They hadn't sort of thought, oh, a new street circuit, we're likely to see some issues here.
Never happened before. Every track that they've introduced, different street circuits, we all know it's famously gone 100% smooth every time. So I don't know why they would need to think that.
Yeah, it was a little bit short-sighted there. And then obviously fans with just tickets for the Friday were given a $200 gift voucher by way of an apology, which feels like a bit of a kick in the dick.
Absolutely woeful.
Especially if you spent what I think even just a grandstand ticket for the Friday was the best part of like $800, I want to hazard a guess at.
As well, like, if you saw some of the merchandise that they had and the prices of that, $200 does not scrape you jack shit.
Yeah, it gets you.
Most you might get a hat, but even then, you know, it's like you're not going to go all that way. Like, and I got a hat and I got 200 bucks off it. Wait, what? You had to spend 200 quid on a hat? What does it do? Not much.
I went to FP1 and all I got was this lousy cap. Like, it's...
I wouldn't even say that.
Well, yeah. But it's a concept that just... It feels like there was a few sort of...
It doesn't surprise me that they're suing them.
At the end of it. Yeah, there is a... I think it's a class action suit that's being put together in favour or reportedly in favour of the fans that are attending. But it was a bit of a mess. And obviously, with things rolling on late into the night, there were reports, again, this was sort of coming from people within the paddock, that at least two teams had their sort of strategy teams just sort of up and leave halfway through. They all disappeared off to bars and clubs in a bid to try and stay awake, just to sort of go somewhere, because they had nothing to do. They had no data to go off from FP1. And as a strategist, you've got nothing to do in FP2. You have a run plan and just hope that they get stuck to. So they just sort of all upped and left to, I think it was a bar they all went off to. And one team sort of arrived at the bar and was sort of having second thoughts about it, thinking, now we should probably head back. Feels bad to be sort of shirking off work. And they get in there and found that there was another team strategy group already in there, just going, we've got nothing to do. We're just waiting for numbers at this point. We're just waiting for FP2 to give us something. So it was that was kind of a funny story to emerge. But more interestingly, and this again speaks for the weird timings of Vegas, was that because Ocon and Sainz started with a new chassis, generally speaking, to avoid teams rebuilding cars in a rush, you have to, if you enter a new chassis, it has to be the next day. So if you were to bin it on a Friday, you can't quickly rebuild it and put it out again later on in Friday. You have to wait till Saturday. This encourages teams to take care when rebuilding their cars, ensure the process is done properly. But because it took so long to get FP2 back up, or FP2 started because of the road repairs and everything, the clock ticked over from Friday to Saturday, which meant that in the time that Ferrari and Alpine had basically rebuilt their cars, the timer had reset, it was a new day, and they were allowed to enter their new chassis, despite the fact that it's still technically being the run plan from the previous day, which they wouldn't have been allowed to do because it took so long. They were allowed to enter. So
finally, again, a benefit to having the weekend at such city times.
Yeah, it was a weird little benefit to it. And again, one of those weird quirks and rules that only comes out at the strangest of events, like when you sort of get the things that say, if a snail passes through and the snail's name happens to be Maria Lee, you're allowed to run a car that's got a billion horsepower or something. It's one of those weird things that's hidden at the back of a rule book that all of a sudden someone's gone, hang on, we can get the car into FP2 if we're looking at their watch going, look, we've got to wait 15 minutes, boys, and we can get that out on track. So we might as well start rebuilding it. The clock will roll over. It's eligible to go. So there's... Yeah, one of those weird moments of FP of Formula One sort of going, oh yeah, we didn't think about that rule. Oh well. That's not to say that the rest of the practice sessions went without hitch. We saw in FP3, Alex Albon cracked a wheel and lost a tyre, but somehow Sargeant made it to P3 as well. So there was a lot of hope for the Williams, certainly in sort of one lap pace and short run pace for the Grove outfit. But this is yet another weekend we've seen cars losing tyres or spitting wheels out across the circuit, and it's certainly something that's come in since we've moved to these larger wheels, that either if the wheel cracks and it ejects the tyre, in the case with Albon's, it actually had a huge amount of the wheel, the actual spun carbon fibre, still within the tyre, so it wasn't just like the hub, it was all of it had gone. So I think there's going to be investigations over the winter break as we move to the next sort of setup to find out if there's a way of improving wheel disassembly to improve safety around the circuit, because it doesn't take much for those wheels to get catapulted over catch fencing and into crowds where they can cause a lot of damage. Beyond that though, Leclerc then went on to top qualifying with Verstappen P2 and Russell P3 once you account for Sainz's grid penalty. McLaren were out in Q1, Lewis couldn't find pace in Q2, nor could Perez, but both Williams made it into Q3 and started the race P5 and P6. In interviews and reports from the team, the lower temperatures saw their car not overheat its rear tyres, which essentially in short run gave them more coherent compounds to utilise. This coupled well with a nicely understood low downforce setup and gave the team a good amount of pace, and both drivers were able to maximise it. It was really promising to see Logan Sargeant's sort of development through the season. He's gotten better, certainly, and with the car being a lot more stable but a lot more dynamic, he was able to really utilise that. So there's good signs there, but pole was set in the wee hours of Saturday, and with the Grand Prix set to start at 10 p.m. also on the Saturday in local time, we actually saw that pole and the winner were crowned on the same day. Ultimately different people though, but yeah, in another interesting quirk of the organization, because of course qualifying started at, as the clock ticked over into midnight, most of qualifying and the race actually happened on the same day. Stroll would go on to take a 5-place grid penalty for additional power unit components and dropped from 14th to 19th at the start. Magnussen and Bottas were the other two surprises from in Q3, as was Pierre Gasly, who started the race in P4. And then we
well, it was pretty good. I just think that whilst we did admittedly get a decent race, which I'll get back to in a bit, but I still think that the qualifying, what we see in qualifying, needs to transfer over more to the Grand Prix more often now, because like you said, there was quite a mixed up top 10 there, and especially when you look at the fact that Lewis, Perez, Sainz and both McLarens were out of the mix there as well. You want that kind of jeopardy in the race, and we did get jeopardy in the race, but it wasn't, it was kind of, you could have had this. And what you got wasn't bad, but we want it closer to what we get in qualifying, that kind of jumbled up nature.
Yeah, it's weird that you can have such a jumbled up grid and it so quickly just sort of resets itself come the race.
Mm.
Seems mainly down to tyres.
It does seem to come down to which teams can utilise their tyres. And I think in Vegas with the cold temperatures, that was made more starkly known than anything. Teams that either struggled with sort of getting heat into their tyres or getting too much heat into their tyres, rather, were able to really capitalise on those conditions and make the most of it. That's where we saw sort of the Red Bull not necessarily struggle, but certainly wasn't quite at home. But the likes of Ferrari, Alfa Romeo, Haas were able to really sort of go hammer and tongs at it early on because they knew their cars were able to generate the heat. And with the cooler conditions, they weren't going to grain them up quite so quickly. Of course, moving on from qualifying, we dive headfirst into the race. And the first thing that we see is Max pushing Charles wide into turn one. He earned himself a 5-second penalty for this, which, given that he had just done one lap post the safety car and had already opened up 2 seconds, really looked like it wasn't going to be a very worthwhile penalty. But equally, I did
see a lot of people seem quite unhappy with the stuff, especially for his reaction to and the penalty, the reaction to the penalty, because, yeah, there was no grip. But it meant that the two, like, you're dealing with two of the best drivers in the world, quote unquote, if you believe the WWE or UFC announcement guy at the start. And it just seemed a little sloppy to do that straight away. You could have just, you didn't need to dive for it right there. And then you've got 50 laps. You're meant to be Max Verstappen. You don't need to be doing it so rashly, so early doors. And 5 seconds didn't really do much of anything. I mean, the safety cars were what brought everything back together. And if that had just been a normal-ish race, it would have made zero difference, and ultimately didn't make any difference anyway. So it was just, I know he doesn't even need to be there in the race, Max, at the moment, because everything's wrapped up, but it just seems like, well, why are you going so weirdly aggressive for something that you could have just done down the back straight anyway?
Equally, why not? He's got nothing to lose, might as well.
No, I know, but it's just, you expect better from a higher caliber driver. It's kind of something you'd like, why are you bothering to push him out so far early? It seems a bit like you can't claim that, oh, yeah, grip, but also you know there's not going to be grip. There's, you know, just do it more outlandishly in a much more entertaining way later. You'll have more fun with it rather than just, nah.
I don't think drivers did realise, though, how much or how little grip there really was, though, because as well you had both Carlos and Fernando spinning out, you know, especially Fernando. Whenever do you see Fernando do
Alonso,
that?
Yeah, Fernando Alonso spinning is quite the odd thing. I mean, we'll just wrap up on Max quickly.
But he wasn't going for like an overtake. He's kind of overtaken, but again, it seemed more he just did it by himself. It wasn't as a result of doing anything else, whereas Max just seemed to, he could have made that corner without Charles being there, you know? It's kind of, it seemed more like he was just a good cover for getting past him.
Yeah, I mean, Charles said
of Logan Sargeant, Fernando. So he was doing it for places. He saw his opportunity and went for it, and it ultimately didn't pay out when then he tried to brake and realised, there's no
brakes. Yeah. But I mean, Charles said in an interview afterwards with, I think it was Canal Plus, the French network, that he and Max had already spoken about it, and Max had simply just lost grip on entry and was fighting understeer. It wasn't the best side of the grid to start on that one. It had all the oil and the concrete dust that laid down post parade lap anyway, so he'd likely started the race with cold and dirty tyres. And Max just said that he'd lost grip on entry and was fighting understeer. And if you watch back Max's onboards, he's not not necessarily not in control of the car, but he's fighting a lot more than you'd expect him to. And equally, he said that the two of them had already moved on from it. Like, they're pretty sure that there was no harm lost there. And given the pace the Red Bulls had, he was going to come past at some point. So it's annoying that he lost it, and he felt that he could have been fighting for the win, but ultimately the race ended up. But like we mentioned, Alonso dived up the inside of the pack. He had a very good start, really started sort of launching his way down the field, stormed up the inside of turn one, and then without any grip spins and narrowly missed the back of Logan Sargeant, which would have really ruined his race more so than it sort of panned out as a bit of a flop anyhow. But yeah, even then, Bottas dived on the brakes to avoid him. And then, yeah, Perez runs into the back of Bottas. And at the same time, Hamilton has had contact with Sainz, and Sainz has spun. So it's all a bit chaotic.
It's been 5 minutes since Perez drove into someone anyway, so it's due to happen.
I mean, to be fair, I don't think Perez was expecting Bottas to be A, in front of him, and B, then suddenly lay into the brakes in the sort of high point of turn one. So it's a bit of an odd point to do it, but the whole thing triggered a VSC just so they could quickly sort of tidy up some of the debris that come off of it, which didn't necessarily neutralize things, but very quickly sort of stabilized things at least. We then went racing after the VSC, but with cold tires, Norris suffered a bit of floor contact over a bump coming out onto the back straight and spun out and crashed, which fairly big
spectacularly
shunt. It was quite a spectacular crash, a lot of sparks coming through.
It's just the way that you saw it unfolding. You just had this camera angle, you just saw sparks, and it cut something else. Like, wait, I swear something happened there. And yeah, the camera people are like, oh crap, we go back in, then you see the like the above shot, and you see how close he was to him, to Piastri. Like, that would have been awkward as heck. But
yeah,
just it just the nature of it, like, what happened? Surely something must have hit him. And it was like, no, just wrong place, wrong time, and just out. And just like, yeah, you ain't getting that back.
Yeah, my initial guess was it looked like a sort of botched up shift, like something had gone wrong with the hydraulics, and therefore the gearbox hadn't synced a shift somehow and under-rotated the rear at turn 13. But it was just this bump. If you watch it back beforehand, you do see it just kick, and then he fights it for a good while. But unfortunately, at that point, on cold tyres off the back of a VSC, just goes round on him. And unfortunately, at that point, it was sort of med centered, then off to the hospital as well afterwards. But all accounts,
I could just hear Piastri in my head if he'd been hit, just going, why?
I could have had a chance. Why? But after that, it was a pretty straightforward race with the grid very much unjumbling itself. Max fought back through after his penalty extended stop, saw him lose a lot of positions. Leclerc definitely fought well to defend back past him as well as Max boxed. So he sort of made sure he got the... I would like to have seen him get the overtake done a little bit earlier so he could capitalise on it once. But I think Red Bull sort of made the box call as late as possible to try and avoid that happening. So a smart move there, really, from the Red Bull pit wall. But Leclerc drove well around it and made the one-stop strategy work when it really didn't look like it was going to be the competitive option. And it was a move that Charles had done before, which he then completely telegraphed and put past on Perez again on the final lap. And equally, he had passed Perez doing the same thing earlier on in the race. So Perez surely would have known that that was coming, and you'd have expected Perez to maybe have defended it a bit better. But instead, he just sort of shoots it up the inside and makes it stick going into those sort of final chicane. But ultimately, it was a fantastic race from Charles. I know we'll touch on him later. Hülkenberg and Tsunoda retired. I know Tsunoda retired with a gearbox issue. I'm not entirely certain what the problem was with Hülkenberg's Haas, but it was... Overall, as a race, it was quite good. I've got some additional notes jotted down over here. Crucially, the 2023 Las Vegas Grand Prix recorded 99 overtakes, which is the most for a dry F1 race since China 2016.
Which is depressing, no?
Depressing that it's been so long since we've had a race with a lot of overtakes, but equally it's...
Like IndyCar, if you've got 99 overtakes, I know different, but if they've only got 99, you think that's been a bad race. Whereas now,
yes. Yeah, if you're only getting 99 overtakes, it's a bit of a flop race. Well, one thing I will realise, just flicking back through my notes, I want to go back to qualifying quickly and talk about the tyre temperatures, because I mentioned it a bit with Norris's spin. And at the start of the straight, the main front straight, rear tires, generally speaking, were about 50 degrees Celsius and fronts were about 60 degrees Celsius. By the end of that long straight, the rear tires would have dropped to 25 degrees Celsius and the fronts down to 35. So on average, they're losing 25 degrees Celsius just down that front straight alone. And when you bear in mind that we're no longer running tire blankets, these tires are so sensitive to the heat conditions in them. And you're losing a huge amount of that. And equally, the working range for these Pirellis is 85 to 115 degrees Celsius, which I don't think 115 degrees Celsius is like boiling point of water, but certainly 85 seems about right. Considering they come out of the tire blankets at 70, like we're talking hot tires and they were solid cold this weekend. So it's a little, it's actually quite surprising we didn't see any more accidents than we did.
I think it was weirdly a much better Grand Prix than we were expecting it to be. Again, coming into the weekend, we didn't really know what to expect, but it was better than whatever we thought it might be. But at the same time, I keep reminding myself to take that with a pinch of salt after the year we've had Grand Prix quality-wise. And it's going to be interesting to see if it's a one-off or if it can be better next year or if it's worse. I mean, we've seen Baku, for example, have some great races, and then the last couple of years have been
mediocre,
very just
at the best.
Yeah. So yeah. It was a good start, and I think it definitely salvaged the weekend overall, because with all the other issues surrounding it, if it had then been a boring race, it would have, to hark back to what you were saying earlier, May, given a lot of people who were coming and wanting it to fail, even more ammunition to go, well, that was all worth it then, wasn't it? We got absolutely bugger all, and Max won by 40 seconds down the road and nothing else really happened. Whereas at least this way, be it because of the slightly jumbled up nature of the grid and some of the contacts, such as with Lewis and Piastri and George and Max, and just signs and the different pit strategies going on, we did get some drivers down the bottom of the pack being able to come up several times to try and get back up to the top of it. And that was entertaining. It was nice that you could actually overtake at Vegas, and you obviously had the strip for it, which was the perfect kind of overtaking opportunity. But that wasn't the only place you saw it. You saw some very neat and niche overtakes in other places of the track where you didn't think you were going to get it. And it was weirdly entertaining. Again, it's kind of hard to know. You're kind of sitting there going, did I just enjoy that? Yes, but I wasn't expecting to say that. So I don't know how I'm feeling now. Did you enjoy it, Ellie Mae, or are you yawning because it was, you're remembering it and that is why it was just boring for you?
No, I'm just really tired. I really enjoyed the race, but what I will say is I thought George Russell's 5-second penalty was quite harsh. I mean, it's...
Yeah, agree.
Verstappen's overtake sort of came out of nowhere, a bit sort of almost like Leclerc then did on Perez. It was just that Perez
Leclerc did it cleaner.
But yeah, I think
I was surprised that George got the penalty for that, because I thought if anyone's going to get a bit of a slap on the wrist there, that's going to be Max for leaving it so late there, because where's George supposed to go?
Well, that's what I thought. When Melissa was sort of looking at it, I thought, is Max going to get a penalty? And I thought, nah, it's more of a sort of racing incident.
But so it seemed more racing, but yeah, but you're thinking, if you're going to apportion blame, then it's not going to be on the guy that's just trying to get around a corner before this car just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, I just think George didn't see him, and I thought, yeah, it was just a bit harsh, but maybe because it had been done a few other times throughout the race, the FIA maybe saw that and thought, well, everyone else has done it cleanly and you haven't. I think it's harsh.
It was curious.
It was a little harsh.
I find it interesting, though, with the team radio, but I don't think they told George until after the race, because I wouldn't necessarily have thought maybe you'd still fight that hard towards the end to get P4, but the way it was phrased on the team radio, it was like, does he know he's got a penalty? Or are they just choosing not to tell him until later and just like, let's just see how far we can push him up the grid and then see if we can build a gap, if that's possible, of 5 seconds so that we can do damage limitation and we'll just tell him later? Because I feel like if he'd been told about it, we'd have heard that team radio, because he probably would have had a couple of things to say.
I think it was a little bit of a harsh penalty, but I don't think at the end of the day it scuppered too much of the overall race. And ultimately, I think it was... yeah, he just didn't see him and didn't check, I think. And I think there is a certain aspect that when you're going into corners and you know you're in one of those key attacking zones and you know you've got a driver steaming up behind you, you do sort of, or probably should check a little bit. I think that's possibly sort of more the racing style. But at the end of the day, it was sort of a bit of a nonplussed incident. It didn't really seem to hamper Max's progress too much, and it certainly didn't seem to do much damage to George's race overall.
I would argue that it has, because he fell down behind Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes need all the points that they can get.
It's hampered Mercedes' progress in the championship, but it hasn't really ruined George's on a personal level then. Yeah, I'll give you that. Yeah. But crucially, come the end of the race, this now means that Red Bull are now uncatchable for 1-2 in the Drivers' Championship. So they've done what they wanted to achieve this year, which was not only get another Drivers' title with Max, but also get the 1-2 in the Drivers' standings and get a Constructors' standing as well. So pretty good move there.
Perez has done his hardest to try not to achieve that with them this year at times, so it's a miracle in some respects.
He does seem to have been sort of fighting them in that sort of ambition, but it's come through in the end. He's done exactly what they needed of him, and they seem well pleased, even if it's been a bit stressful at times. Sainz is now, however, tied with Alonso on points, but does lead on countback with his Singapore win for fourth. This also bumps Norris down to sixth, and also weirdly, because of his podium now, this brings Charles back into the mix for that fight for the sort of the top end of the points, which is quite the little battle that's going on there. It's quite fun to keep an eye on. Obviously, Ferrari is now even closer to Mercedes overall. Scrolls up and checks
points.
4 points, isn't it, going into the final round, which is...
And Aston Martin's not too far away. It's like 10 or 9 points away from McLaren, I think. So, I mean, that's doable. I don't see it happening, but it's doable.
Aston Martin are 21 points behind McLaren. Oh, no, hang on.
Okay, they do need McLaren to have a pretty bad weekend, but...
No, they are 11 points behind. Sorry.
That's more doable then. Yeah. Still, it's going to be tricky, but interesting.
Yeah, it's perfectly attainable, but whether or not Abu Dhabi suits the Aston Martin and McLaren, yeah, I have to go pore over my numbers for it. But
so if we take it back to other desert tracks this year, 50-50, Qatar went all right for McLaren, not so good for Aston Martin, but Bahrain went pretty good for Aston Martin, not so good for McLaren. So.
It depends, but obviously there's been a lot of development in that McLaren, so we'll see how it pans out towards that. But yeah, it's bringing the season to a good end. I think we're seeing a few of the final battles really shaking out at this point. So it's been a worthwhile Grand Prix, I think, crucially, in the overall sort of putting together of the year and the season, I'd say. Whether or not the aspects of it that were put around the race were to be enjoyed, or whether the timings were perfectly correct, is yet to be fully nailed down. But I think conceptually, as a race and what it's produced, I think it's been beneficial to the season and providing some interest and insight, certainly.
Do you think
needed it?
It's been put on. They didn't put it on earlier. I mean, one, I guess logistics, but two, because of European time.
On in the day.
Yeah, because we're thinking it's what. They started the race at 10 o'clock, about 6 a.m. for us, 7 a.m.
7 for Continental, yeah. There was very much the case of, generally speaking, around the world, races are held, so they start, I believe it's 2 o'clock UK time. But they're a lot more sort of flexible on that these days. I think they allow for like 3 a.m., 3 p.m. starts. Obviously, that's why we have like Singapore being a night race, is to keep that relatively in regards to sort of being sort of that standard 2 p.m. UK start time. But obviously, there are certain places where that just can't be met. And I think that viewers are getting more and more flexible with that. Things like Suzuka, Australia, sort of being held at different times mean we get different start times. And it's once or twice a year for the vast majority of Formula One's fans. I think they appreciate that it's a bit of a struggle for some fans, but ultimately it's not too bad. But I would possibly argue that you could have factored in the effort that puts onto the teams, especially ahead of a double header, off the back of a triple header.
Well, that goes away for the name of entertainment though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially the double header and the fact that there's such a different time zone.
at least with the triple header they've just done, they've not really sort of hopped around too much with time zones. You're sort of only jumping sort of one or two at any given point in time. It's not too horrid. But going from Las Vegas out to Abu Dhabi, you're jumping forwards in time by 12 hours. You're spending 17 hours on a plane to achieve that or something awful. It really quickly adds up and puts a toll on your body. It's going to be a huge task on teams to not only be functioning on a high level, but also physios to get drivers ready to go out and do something incredibly physical on literally running on fumes at this point. I think physically a lot of the drivers are going to be sort of ready for this season to finish. And
I saw the interview with Sky interviewing Esteban Ocon, and they said, you know, are you going to go out and party? And he was like, well, if my physio tells me that I have to stay up, then yes, because it's the only way that's going to keep me awake.
Yeah, to sort of essentially stay up, because then immediately the first thing you start doing after you finish one race is start getting onto the time zone of the next, so you're immediately ready to deal with that next Grand Prix as best as possible. But we'll move on from all of that and we'll pass through some more analysis with our winners and spinners section. We'll start with some winners and we'll start with possibly an obvious one, Ellie May.
I've gone for Charles Leclerc. I mean,
no notes, perfection.
Yeah, such a strong weekend from him. Overtook both Red Bulls on outright pace. I mean, Perez had more downforce on his car, which obviously caused him to be slower, but, you know, Perez could have equally defended that corner a lot better. And I think, has anyone else overtaken Max Verstappen?
Not this season, no.
Which,
for me, the move on Max was not the one where he got past. It was the one where he tried to get past a second time. And you see them both go onto the brakes as both cars sort of start retarding. And then you see Charles lift the brakes and tries it to send it that bit longer, but knows that he has to get back on to slow the car a bit more. And it's that sort of, I'm going to keep trying. And I absolutely love to see that. It didn't pay off for a pass. He wasn't going to get it around the outside, but to try and make that move on the brakes, not into a braking zone, but on the brakes when both cars are already slowing down, is a true racing driver's move, and really like seeing that. So yeah, for me, if you're calling Charles Leclerc a winner on this, no complaints, no notes, perfection, chef's kiss.
The tyres seemingly didn't suffer much degradation for Ferrari as well. He really looked after them quite well. Struggled on that.
It was his window. It was like a perfect operating window for him, those tyres and that car. It really sort of came into its own with those conditions. And maybe a winter series would be quite fun with these cars if that's how they kind of treat their tyres. But yeah, I think at the end of the day,
the series all across Canada.
Yeah. While Red Bull might have come away with the winner's trophy, I think the sort of moral victor and the driving talent sort of victor from this was Charles Leclerc.
Yeah, I think I'd like to know how different his and Carlos's setup was. I know Carlos was obviously battling a lot more drivers, but to be suffering from overheating, what did Ferrari do?
I think it was because they were running with such closed off ducts because they knew it was going to be cool, but they didn't anticipate perhaps it getting warm if you're sat in traffic, and equally because you're hemmed in with street circuits because you've got the walls so close, it builds like a tiny microcosm of an environment below those sort of 5 foot concrete barriers that quickly sort of heats up into like a weird pocket that doesn't dissipate, so the cars very quickly in traffic get warm. But yeah, no notes for me on Charles Leclerc. Timo, who have you picked for your winner?
And I mean, I don't even like saying it, Lance Stroll. Admittedly, he did look out a bit on strategy, but he did actually manage to keep his head down and stay out of trouble, mainly due to chaos and drama around him, leaving him untouched. And it does feel a little bit too late, too little too late for him generally, but he did good. And it doesn't feel, I'm going to have to wash my mouth out in a minute for saying it, because it just doesn't feel right. But it just weirdly credit where it's due, even if it's just Vegas being Vegas. Of course, Lance Stroll had to somehow do well in all of that. And it's I didn't have that on my bingo card. We should move on. It's too weird.
On tracks where the, or on circuits where the track provides as much grip as a sheet of glass doused in fairy liquid, Lance Stroll becomes god tier when it comes to driving. The car, I don't think, quite had the pace, and I don't think the strategy quite supported him utilizing it to its full. But my God, he was driving really well this weekend. And equally, one thing I will say is it's really nice seeing Lance Stroll always so proud of his son when he's doing well. Like,
you mean Lawrence Stroll?
Lawrence Stroll, even, yeah. When you see him get out of the car and, like, Lawrence is...
I knew that driver wasn't going to have been Lance. He had a son this whole time and he stuck him in the F1 car instead.
You just see Lawrence beaming from ear to ear and he's pleased and happy with what his son's done. He's like, yeah. I think also still because Lance is just simply living Lawrence's dreams vicariously, but the concept lives.
Perhaps, like you said, we should have a winter series.
Yeah. Lance Stroll likes a winter series. I think he did one in F4 once and was absolutely boss at it, but we'll see what happens there. But that's Timo's winner, and he's gone to quickly wash his mouth out with soap. Meanwhile, for me, my winner is Esteban Ocon. And it's sort of one of those things of I didn't expect it. I didn't really anticipate there being a P4 for Ocon for coming so far down the grid. But yeah, just paid out for the boy. One-stop strategy, made it work, looked after his tyres, didn't get hung up too much fighting through the fields, so he was able to really make his tyres last a long time. Pulled off an absolute worldie of a move on Pierre Gasly, despite team orders to stay behind him. And pulled it off in a part of the circuit where you weren't expecting it. I think it was into the right-hander heading towards the sphere section. So it was, yeah, an odd place to make the move, but he pulled it off and made it stick on sort of braking and corner entry. And yeah, just really good weekend from Esteban Ocon. He's sort of one of those drivers, much like Lance Stroll, his friend, that gets easily overlooked. But occasionally when they have those good drives, they are truly phenomenal drives. And especially because it's sort of against the odd of the machinery and the race itself.
The annoying thing is it could have quite easily been Alpine as the winners. And I don't know what happened to Pierre Gasly that second half of the race, because he had been so phenomenal for the whole entire weekend.
Yeah, he remembered he was driving an Alpine.
He was running experimental parts on the car. He was running a slightly different car in and of itself. There were different elements to it that they were sort of prepping ahead of 24. So I think that ultimately that might have given him better one lap pace. But when it came to the race, obviously they were looking for data and numbers off of how the car was responding to things. And yeah, given where Alpine sits within the constructor standings, they've got a bit of scope for playing around. I don't think they've got quite the same with their drivers. I know both Esteban and Pierre are fighting Stroll for sort of bottom of the top 10 at the moment. So it's an interesting battle there, but I think, yeah, with both of them playing out with sort of prototype parts, it's quite interesting. Let's see, where's Checks numbers? Ocon 58 points, Gasly 62 points, so just 4 points separate them, and Stroll is on 73, so they're all within sort of touching distance of one another. I think Ocon might be a bit far out to try and get Stroll at this point, but yeah, certainly Gasly against Stroll, there's possibility of something happening, and they might swap the field again when it comes to Abu Dhabi, like we've seen them sort of swap back and forth before.
They both have experimental parts, and Esteban Ocon have to go back to an old chassis with his...
It was after the crash, yeah. They swapped Esteban back to a rather more standard setup, and I think come the race, because that was slightly more understood against the long plan data, it paid off for him. So it's sort of, sod's law, it paid out that way. But I think at the end of the day, to still produce that drive on a one-stop when those around you are going bold on the two-stops really shows off sort of quite a good level of talent there. On the flip side, we'll go to the spinners, and we'll start with Timo, because yours is relatively straightforward to explain.
Yes, AlphaTauri. I was going to go for Haas, but it seemed mean to go for them again. So I thought I'll go for AlphaTauri, just because they didn't seem to really be able to convert anything all weekend, and it's a shame given recent promise. And it may have cost them the position in the constructors that they were going to go and get from Williams, potentially. It's doable still, but again, they need to have a belter of an Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, and it piles a lot more pressure on them that they really didn't need, and could have done with at least one of the cars up there, and neither one was there, unfortunately. And it was, Yuki absolutely dire in qualifying, and Daniel getting a bit further up the grid, but again, for a track where, in an atmosphere where you think Ricciardo would somehow thrive here and just be able to harness the power of Vegas to push his car forward, it didn't work. So it was a shame to see that on that side. And I think every team kind of had elements of something. I mean, even McLaren qualifying in the race for Lando particularly didn't go well, but Piastri was sitting up there in third at one point going, how do I stay here? So there were moments of brilliance for everyone, and you can look at that with Williams and Alfa Romeo in qualifying. Alpine, like we said, they had a bit of an topsy-turvy time. Every team had something, but AlphaTauri just didn't.
They didn't really sparkle this weekend. There was just a sort of flatness to them as a team.
The like go-faster stripes didn't work.
All the other teams had a moment where they looked good, whether it was qualifying or the race.
It was at least a flash in the pan moment.
Yeah, but AlphaTauri just didn't even have the flash in the pan, which was upsetting. But when it comes to spinners, I think here, Ellie Mae and I go... or sort of butt heads a bit. You've gone for the haters and I've gone for the organisers.
I've gone for the haters because even if you take out, you know, anything, whether, you know, you're trying to create a spectacle or whatever, you just look at the race itself. We had a good race.
Yeah, I cannot deny that. I think, though, when it comes to the organisers, there were a lot of things that they sort of fell short on or possibly overlooked, and... on a practical side, I would have liked for it to have been done better. I'm not saying the whole weekend was a flop or it was all bad, but there were certain bits that certainly could have been done better when it came to focusing on the race. The entertainment side of it, the entertainment value, the showmanship, incredible. And I don't really hate that on reflection. Like I said, if we're going to have a goofy-ass race weekend, having it in Vegas and making it the big top, sort of the greatest show on earth, sort of... drama of it all, fantastic, love it, I'm on board with that. But you need to have the sort of solid base to run it off of, and when your track isn't fully like certified until just before the track action starts, and when you've got parade cars that are leaking oil onto the starting grid, and you've got bumps that are spitting people off, it starts to feel a little bit 1970s sort of Detroit and Dallas when you've got tracks that are breaking up under the heat of the sort of summer sun in sort of America, and it and Nigel Mansell's fainting pushing his car across the finish line. It sort of starts to feel a bit farcical in that sort of way, like things weren't properly thought through. But at the end of the day, I will give it credit where it's due, and yeah, as much as I sort of have a few bones to pick, I don't hate it as a weekend. And unfortunately, it sort of very much flies in the face of what I said with our season-long predictions. We made these way back at the start of the year, and I did include on the questions, will Las Vegas suck? And I've coloured my one in red because I said, yes, it will. And I can't say that with my chest. I can't truthfully say that Las Vegas as a Grand Prix weekend sucked. And
what did I say?
You said no.
Son of a bitch.
So do you think Las Vegas, you seem pretty positive about the whole sort of race and the race weekend. So I think...
I based it purely on the racing because I knew that if I start doing that for stuff surrounding Grand Prix, then there's going to be a lot of arguments about this whole season. But yeah, if I take it purely on the racing, it didn't suck. No, so well done me.
Yeah, there's going to be points to you at the end of the year. Ellie Mae, you described it as car park, as exciting as. So unfortunately, you've fallen into the same trap as I have and will have, when I come to top this up, lose points.
I remember saying it because I remember just being really, really tired at on the top floor of Olympia. And you're next to me like, just give me an answer.
Will it suck, yes or no? And you go, it's going to be as exciting as a car park. I'm like, okay, cool. A lot of other people really weren't positive about it. But a few people said no. And so they will have earned themselves points for that, which is quite impressive. So, yeah, well done to those people.
I guess in answer to the organisers being a spinner, is that I think I would I don't know, maybe I'll actually give people the benefit of the doubt, and I think I will let them have sort of see their flaws, and if they pick up on that and they, you know, do whatever needs to be done next year so that we don't have those issues and they iron them all out, then I think that's fine. I think if we come to next year and we've got these same issues, then I will be a bit harsher on them.
Yes, likewise, if next year they solve all these problems, I'm I'm willing to go back through my files and retroactively remove my spinner's accolade from them. But we'll do that in about 365 days' time. Any other drivers that we really feel are worth a mention? I feel we've touched a lot of the main points across this, to be fair. Lewis Hamilton, I think he made 19 overtakes across the course of the race, which is pretty good going. But again,
yeah, it would have been nice if he could have... Like, again, he's been showing really good pace and form over the second half of the season, and it was unfortunate what happened to him in this one, because he could have been up there fighting them. I don't know if he would have got on the podium or would have got the win, but he would have been in the mix at least, and with him in the form that he's in, want to see him involved at the very least. So it would have been interesting, especially if he's having to battle Russell, then going to get Stroll and Ocon. You know, you kind of, it's the same thing with Sainz for this reason. You're seeing drivers out of position that you know should be up there fighting hard for it, even if they're not necessarily going to get on the podium, they're going to be darn close. And yeah, it just was unfortunate that he wasn't able to do that.
I would like to know their reasoning behind why they gave Russell a penalty, but yet they didn't give Hamilton a penalty for essentially colliding with Piastri.
Difference.
We've had both called racing incidents in my mind, so I'm like, I'm still with you on the Russell thing. I don't see why that should have, why that warrants it. And yeah, no, I don't understand it either.
Yeah, for me, they're both racing incidents, but I would have thought, just due to the outcome, it would have been Hamilton's and Piastri's was a lot worse, maybe because Hamilton, I guess, kind of got a little bit punished at the fact that he had to go around a whole entire circuit on three wheels.
Mm, yeah, he lost out by having to do that lap with a puncture, and a few other people got a chance to do it differently. So, yeah, it was unique in that regard. We'll move on from anointing some winners and spinners to our predictions review, which was pretty much spinners across the board for a lot of us. No points awarded for pole position. 1 point to both team owner Ali Maide for predicting a Verstappen win. Congratulations on being so bold as to say that much. No points awarded for fastest lap. No points for wild predictions, though 17 cars did finish. So it's sort of the 1 over XX over 1 for Timo's predicting 3 cars finishing. It was not great when it came to predictions.
Should have put a bet on that one. I don't know what the odds would have been on 17 cars finishing, but I might have made up either.
I don't know. I put a load of bets on at the end of the preview episode. The only one that I got come out was a safety car. So yeah, congratulations to me. That's why I don't bet very often, because I always lose money on it, so I never bother.
I've got 2 points, and I was on for 2 points right until Leclerc took Perez. I was like, oh darn it!
I did see that. I think that's made my day even more now, because that was funny enough at the time.
I just thought, you know, for how I tried to go, maybe my podium wasn't wild, but the thought behind it was. And I thought, what are the chances of that kind of working out? And then, oh, Leclerc to Perez. That's me done. Shame.
Mm. It was a bit more optimistic for some people when it came to our fantasy league, though, with
teams zero, we didn't even know we had in the league.
Yeah, 0 shots needed, Guerros and Too Tall, Too Boy. All scoring into the 300-point range. 0 shots needed, 330. Guerros, 316. Too Tall, Too Boy is 315. I believe 0 shots needed and Too Tall, Too Boy are my girlfriend's teams, which were sort of picked off very strange arbitrary rules, mainly off of shots needed and the height of the drivers involved. So it's surprising that somehow they've panned out as they have.
I would like to know who is in her 0 shots needed team.
I can go and find out for you. Hang on. So 0 shots needed. We have Carlos Sainz, Esteban Ocon, Valtteri Bottas, Lance Stroll, Charles Leclerc.
That's an interesting mix.
Any further comments about my girlfriend will be redacted from this podcast.
I think some shots are needed for some, for at least one of those drivers, but that's personal preference.
Yeah, I'd like to have a conversation with her about her choices.
I'm sure you'll get an opportunity to make those discussions at a later point in time. When it came to our teams, Jaffa Cake Racing had a pretty decent weekend, actually. P6, EMT Racing P14, and On the Curbs P20. Overall, it is still Alex H9V2 at the top of the league with 6,272 points, Francisco Rhodes with 6,146 points, and Alex H9, 6,010. EMT Racing is still the lead out of us lot in P6, Midbeds Racing in P12, and On the
P11
Curbs.
P11.
P11. Oh, you've missed.
Yeah, because I realised I was 12th and then realised I must have just missed the two.
Yeah, no, you're correct. Midbeds Racing is actually in P10. Jaffa Cake Racing is P11. On the Curbs is P12. So I've got two teams directly ahead of you, but a long way short of EMT.
Pretty locked in on P12, to be honest. I think I'm quite happy where I am. You need to have quite a bad Abu Dhabi, and I need to have a pretty good one.
It's only 129 points between the two of us, so you could catch me.
Yeah, but you need to have a pretty bad race, is what I'm saying there.
Yeah, I've got Verstappen, Sainz, Russell, Hülkenberg, Piastri, McLaren,
Ferrari, and Jack. If you could just put the threes in your team by five along with Lawson, that'd be great.
I could, but I don't want to. Speaking of putting in pointless drivers, Liam, I love you, still tails at the bottom of the fantasy league with 1,259 points, 34th overall, which puts, given that 33rd is on 2,156 points, it's a long way shy. It's about
33rd is going to need a rough race to
lose that. Yeah, I don't know what bonuses you could put on to get nearly 1,000 points in one race, but that's by the by. And
is
brings
it
us
me still in 33rd? Is it me still in 33rd?
Which one was yours in 33rd? Experiment underdog. Yep, you are currently in 33rd with Ocon, Hülkenberg, Albon, Piastri, and Stroll. So very much the underdogs there. But McLaren and Williams, probably over the last few races, doing you quite well.
Yeah.
That's how you secure that P33.
Which is also mad that they were the
underdogs at the start of the season.
At the start of the year. Because I literally did this as
well,
the
Well, Stroll makes sense. Piastri would be a rookie. Albon, we weren't 100% sure with the Williams. And Hülkenberg, we weren't sure either because he was coming back in. Ocon.
Yeah. It was a pretty interesting selection, or a clever selection if you're going for the underdogs. But anyway, that brings us neatly to the end of this week's episode. And I'd like to bring back the section where we thank the listeners in. And I've had a flick around on some of our analytics of where this show goes out to and some of the interesting locations. And I've picked out two for this week. And I'd like to say thank you to our listeners who are enjoying the podcast in Ludwigsburg, which is just north of Stuttgart in Germany. And an equally warm welcome goes to those who join us in Marionette, which is in Wisconsin. Your city on the bay, I think, is their tagline. Go Green Bay Packers, I guess. But anyway, with all that said and done, Timo, where can the people find you?
You can find me over on the Curbs, the Nitro RX podcast, Flexrot, Instagram, and Is It Fast, where sometime in the not too distant future, there will be an interview with endurance racer Laura and just about anything these days, Samantha Tan.
Fantastic. Ellie Mae, where can the people find you?
Doing my graphics on the Instagram account or on TikTok.
Maybe she sounds more and more confident that that's where she's going to be every week.
Yeah, maybe my bed.
So it's getting to that winter season. Ellie Mae goes into hibernation once the final race happens. She sort of bunkers down. We don't see her till spring.
I don't like the cold.
No, that is plain to be seen. In the meantime, though, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok as @JesseOnCars, and also writing for Classic Car Weekly. I can't remember what you're going to be able to. No, if you buy the issue that's coming out next, which will be on shop shelves on Wednesday, you can read about the time I took my MG to the Lake District and had a good old time there with that one. So, worth picking up just for that. So, plenty of pretty pictures in there too.
I saw CCW in the newspaper and magazine section of Tesco's today.
Yeah, it's out there. You can go and buy it and pick up a copy, or simply read it and then put it back on the shop shelf. It would rather you picked it up and bought it so it gets recorded into our circulation figures. But anyway, that's all we've got time for this week. We'll be back in a couple of days' time with a preview for the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix.